Welcome, everybody. This is Christopher Bandini, one of your hosts of New Books in Psychoanalysis. And today we are going to be here with the editors of two volumes about interpersonal psychoanalysis, Donald Stern and Erwin Hirsch. I'm going to give their introductions first, and then we'll speak about their books, volumes 1 and 2, The Interpersonal Perspective in Psychoanalysis, the 1960s to the 1990s, Rethinking Transference and Countertransference, and Further Developments in Interpersonal Psychoanalysis, 1980s to 2010s, Evolving Interest in the Analyst's Subjectivity, and those are both in Routledge. So first, Dr. Erwin Hirsch is a faculty supervisor and former director of the Manhattan Institute for Psychoanalysis. He's a distinguished visiting faculty at the William Allison White Institute, adjunct professor of psychology and supervisor, postgraduate program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis at Adelphi University, clinical adjunct professor of psychology and supervisor, postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis at New York University, faculty and supervisor at the National Training Institute, National Institute for the Psychotherapies, editorial board for contemporary psychoanalysis, psychoanalytic dialogues, and psychoanalytic perspectives. He is the author of over 80 psychoanalytic articles, chapters and reviews, and 4 books. Including the 2008 Guther Award-winning Coasting in the Countertransference, Conflicts of Self-Interest Between Analyst and Patient. And now on to Dr. Donald Stern, who is the training and supervising analyst at the William Allison White Institute in New York City. He's the clinical consultant and adjunct clinical professor of psychology at the NYU postdoctoral program in psychoanalysis and psychotherapy and faculty, New York Psychoanalytic Institute. He is the founder and editor of a book series at Routledge, Psychoanalysis in a New Key, which is about 50 books in print and another 15 in various stages of completion. He is the former editor-in-chief of Contemporary Psychoanalysis. He has written many articles and book chapters and 4 books on formulated experience from dissociation to imagination in psychoanalysis, Partners in Thought, Working with Unformulated Experience, Dissociation and Enactment, Relational Freedom, Emergent Properties of the Interpersonal Field, The Infinity of the Unsaid, Unformulated Experience, Language, and the Nonverbal. He is also the co-editor of Pioneers of Interpersonal Psychoanalysis and the Handbook of Interpersonal Psychoanalysis. He serves as the associate editor of Psychoanalytic Dialogues and is a member of the editorial boards of Psychoanalytic Inquiry, Psychoanalytic Psychology, the Psychoanalytic Quarterly, and the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Institute. He is in private practice in New York City. I hope we have enough time for the interview after those lengthy introductions. A very formidable two gentlemen that I'm here with today to speak about their important volumes on interpersonal psychoanalysis. So as we are accustomed to doing here on this podcast, we usually ask how you came to write this book, these books, two of them.
Well, Don. Erwin, how do you want to go about this? Shall I say how it started?
You wrote the book proposal to initiate it. So why don't you start, and I'll add if there's anything to add. Okay.
Okay. So I thought years ago that there was a book, one of the books that you mentioned in going through that introduction, which Chris I would say was generous, except we wrote them. one of the books that you mentioned is called Pioneers of Interpersonal Psychoanalysis, and I co-edited that book with a number of other people back in, I think it was published in 95. And the format of that book was that we took the first generation of interpersonal psychoanalysts, and we took one paper from each of those people, a classic paper, and we had current interpersonalists of that day write prologues for the papers that we published in the book. So each paper was accompanied by a prologue. And some years ago, it occurred to me, you know, that interpersonal psychoanalysis isn't as well known as I would like it to be in the world at large, and that it would make sense to do similar books about the later generations, more contemporary generations of interpersonal psychoanalysts. So that's what we did. I wrote a proposal, I don't know, it's been a number of years ago now, for Routledge, in which that same idea was proposed for two different generations, roughly. They're overlapping. One of them was the 1960s to the 1990s era one, and the other one is the other one is 1980s to the 2010s. And we did the same thing. You know, I had set up a table of contents, but eventually what happened is that I was complaining one day to Irwin, who's a good friend, and was just saying, you know, I don't know how I'm ever going to get this done. And he had the bright idea, let's do it together. So I thought, gee, that's a good idea.
It's an interpersonal idea.
Yeah. It would never have gotten done had Irwin not had that comment, because I don't know that I ever would have done it by myself. And we rejiggered the table of contents, you know, to reflect Irwin's interests as well as mine. And we agreed that to begin with, it was always going to be two volumes. And the way we did it was, in the first volume, I wrote the introductory, there's an introductory chapter for the whole book. And then Irwin wrote the prologues, one for each paper all the way through the book. And then the second book, we just reversed roles. So Irwin wrote the introduction, then I wrote the prologues for each chapter. Irwin, you got something you might want to add there?
Yeah. Don, we had discussed this a number of years ago when Don has so many irons in the fire and is so active in writing and being on editorial boards. He forgot that we had long ago talked about doing such a book. And so when I heard he was planning it, I said, hey, we once talked about this.
I'd forgotten it even until now, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, I said I want in. Plus, he was saying that he was so overwhelmed with obligations that he might not ever do it. And so, fueled by obsessive compulsive ambitions and getting things done quickly, we started to do it together and made some changes in the articles that we chose. I mean, the underlying reason for both of us is that each of us felt that the importance of the interpersonal tradition in contemporary psychoanalysis is just under-recognized. And the hope was that, you know, Don's hope with that other book in 1995 is that it would those contributions would be more recognized, and our hope for these two volumes is that more people will recognize how much relational psychoanalysis and contemporary psychoanalysis in general is so powerfully influenced by the interpersonal tradition.
Maybe it would be helpful to go back. There was classical psychoanalysis. We were talking at the beginning of the 20th century, and along comes Harry Stack Sullivan. Now, people may not be familiar of how the interpersonal tradition developed alongside of the classical tradition. If you can speak to that.
Irwin, you want to?
Okay. They were a very isolated group, and the hegemonic classical psychoanalysis of 1940s through 1970s and even early 80s just had no interest in what Sullivan introduced, and his influence was minimal outside of New York City and the White Institute and NYU postdoctoral and a little bit of Adelphi postdoctoral and somewhat in Washington where he started. So there was no cross-fertilization. The interpersonalist had this kind of rebellious attitude that, we're the revolutionaries, and we don't really have to read the classical literature or try and integrate it. And classical psychoanalysis in general in this country dismissed it as sort of superficial social psychology and or calling it the cultural school, that being a negative connotation. Then interpersonal psychoanalysis sort of avoided the nitty-gritty of basic instincts of sex and aggression. And contemporary psychoanalysis was the journal of the White Institute, and people who identify as interpersonal usually read that journal only, and nobody outside of those interests ever read contemporary psychoanalysis. My take is, and I've written about this, that Greenberg and Mitchell's book in 1983 was the game changer, and that book had such wide success and wide recognition that basically introduced interpersonal perspective to a much, much wider audience. And so began the relational movement, to which interpersonal tradition, I think, is the most important contributor.
So, Chris, can I add to that?
Sure.
So, you know, the problems in American psychoanalysis, and I'm talking about North American psychoanalysis, because I think it becomes clearer and clearer to us as time passes that we have been chauvinistic and ethnocentric in our understanding of psychoanalysis. And these days, European and South American psychoanalysis have a lot more currency in American psychoanalytic life. But until recently, psychoanalysis in North America has meant, you know, Freudian and what's now called contemporary Freudian theory, conflict theory, on the one hand, and interpersonal psychoanalysis, and then, as Erwin said, relational psychoanalysis on the other. But the dividing line has been not only clinical and intellectual, it's also been political. And there's an important motivation in both those realms to do these books. In the 40s, and you know, it wasn't just Sullivan. For the first generations of interpersonalists, Fromm was just as important a clinical influence as Sullivan. Matter of fact, Fromm was a more important clinical interest than Sullivan. Sullivan was a more important intellectual and clinical intellectual and what was the word I was looking for there? Well, anyway, he conceptual.
Theoretical.
He was a more important theoretical influence, but Fromm had the commitment to what you could call humanistic existential values. In fact, the track at NYU that reflects this kind of thinking is still known as the IH track, the interpersonal humanistic track, and that's largely because of Fromm's influence. Tell you just a very brief story. When I finished my training about 1980, I did a survey of the senior analysts at White, who at that point were much older than me. Now I'm their age. And I asked them a number of questions, one of which was, who was your most important clinical influence? And all of the senior people said it was Fromm. Mm-hmm. Sullivan, you know, they acknowledged Sullivan as terribly important, of course. But Fromm's directness, spontaneity, his unwillingness to sacrifice any vitality in what he could create in the clinical setting really inspired these people. So you'll see both the influences of Fromm and Sullivan, as well as the other early interpersonalists in these two volumes. That would be from Reichman and Clara Thompson, Ernest Schachtel, and a few others. Schachtel is a little later, but roughly the same era. Sullivan, incidentally, just to add to what Erwin said about that, Sullivan was really influential in Washington, D.C. In the Washington-Baltimore area, he was the dominant psychiatric influence in his time there. Everybody knew who he was, and everybody knew his teachings, but it had not gone national, certainly not international. When he came to New York to start to teach with his colleagues at the newly formed, it was called the New York Division of the Washington School of Psychiatry in 1943, these people started internationalizing his ideas. But he had been highly influential in Washington. I teach a course on interpersonal and relational psychoanalysis at New York Psychoanalytic Institute, and one of the students in it happens to be in her 80s, and she was telling me just the other day how much Sullivan had to do with what everybody thought in those days. So he was a very heavy influence on, well, for example, one of the first generation or second generation of interpersonalists, Harold Searles, is very close to Erwin's heart too. Was heavily influenced by the atmosphere that Sullivan created. And of course, at Chestnut Lodge, there was also Frieder von Reichman in those days.
Yeah, so there was this first...
influence, I think, unless you don't agree, was largely working analytically with more seriously disturbed patients.
His influence, though, was not, I mean, for example, he influenced Lowald. Lowald was no Sullivanian, for sure, but Lowald took several courses with Sullivan. He was a heavy influence on all of psychiatry, from what I understand. I mean, obviously, I wasn't there. But from what I understand, the Washington-Baltimore area was dominated by that, by his interpersonal, what he called interpersonal psychiatry or interpersonal relations. I mean, Chris, yeah. As you know, he...
Mm-hmm. Interpersonal psychoanalysis was originally interpersonal psychiatry.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. There's three leaps. There seems to be a big leap from Sullivan, who by his own words, practiced psychiatry, and that Clara Thompson, I suppose, is the person given credit for taking his work and making it into psychoanalysis. And it seems like in your books, the first book is one leap into the next generation, and then the second book kind of goes towards the contemporary writers of interpersonal psychoanalysis. But it was an important turning point where Clara Thompson and others formulated Sullivan's work in the language of psychoanalysis, if I'm correct.
Yeah, I think so, because, I mean, Clara Thompson was psychoanalytically trained classically in New York, and Eric Fromm was psychoanalytically trained classically in Berlin, and Sullivan was an autodidact. He was never psychoanalytically trained. And so, you know, our first book talks about transference and countertransference, or at least that's the theme. Sullivan didn't deal with transference or use countertransference particularly. And Thompson, I think, was the one. Primarily, Thompson, who integrated him into what was more considered psychoanalysis, and the use, particularly the use of transference.
I agree wholeheartedly, and I would say the same thing if I were saying what you said, Erwin. But to that, for those people, I'd add. I mean, there were other people of her generation who are not remembered the way that they might be. Ralph Crowley, for example, wrote a very wonderful paper called "Human Reactions of Analysts to Patients" in the about 1950. Ed Tauber wrote in the early 50s about the use of countertransference in a paper that he was so roundly criticized for that he didn't write that much after that. Then there were others as well. It turns out that the phrase interpersonal psychoanalysis, Chris, was never even used until 1964, which was the time when Maury Green published a book of the selected papers of Clara Thompson. And in casting around for a title for that book, he settled on interpersonal psychoanalysis because he thought, you know, that's what she did, like Erwin said. She pulled this stuff together. She saw that you could pull together Fromm's more traditional psychoanalytic notions with Sullivan's, which were more radically different, and come up with a psychoanalysis, with a body of work that it would be fair to call psychoanalysis. And I agree with Erwin. She saw this, and this was, in a sense, one of her life's projects. I mean, she also was interested in the psychology of women and wrote a lot about that. But this was one of the very important things about her. The course of history in interpersonal psychoanalysis, really, when I got to the Institute, the White Institute, and when training in the 1970s, every issue of Contemporary Psychoanalysis, which is the only place that interpersonalists could publish, because we had been blackballed basically from all of the traditional mainstream psychoanalytic journals and had been denied admission to the American Psychoanalytic Association. That was what I meant by political before. Every time there was an issue that came out, we excitedly looked to see what papers would be published by Wolstein and Levinson, who I think the two of them, Erwin, I don't know, I think you'd agree with this, the two of them really established interpersonal psychoanalysis as what it became, and because of their, you know, their doctrine, their understanding of you can't not interact with the patient. You're always unconsciously involved.
Oh, I would definitely agree. I would add Erwin Singer to a somewhat lesser extent.
And Harold Searles.
And Harold Searles, yes. But both Levinson and Wallstein were enormously influenced by Clara Thompson.
I know.
Mm-hmm. I know she was Wallstein's analyst. I don't. Was she Levinson's analyst or supervisor?
No, but he was. He was fairly well acquainted with her. I think she supervised him.
Mm-hmm. I think in the books, especially in the first volume, or certainly the second two, there are certain concepts that are illustrated about interpersonal psychoanalysis, and not everyone, I think, may be familiar with how interpersonal psychoanalysis differs, other than I think what you said, Erwin, that it was kind of considered more lighter or social psychology. But Donnell, in the first volume, you have a list of ways that interpersonal psychoanalysis differed or differs from classical analysis. I'm going to kind of read a couple of things here from that, and it says it's different in terms of Oedipal conflict, the inevitability of transference neurosis, the insistence on defining psychoanalysis as the application of a single technique, penis envy, death instinct, drive theory in general, de-emphasis of real experience with real people, and also with theories of libido and rigidly unfolding psychosexual stages. You can imagine that as kind of a shot across the bow against classical analysis, in the sense of kind of maybe it would be helpful to think of what's left. What does interpersonal psychoanalysis espouse? What does it keep, and what does it kind of stand for?
Well, Chris, before we do that, let me just go back to the list that you read, because it's really important to emphasize that the difference was not that these things are all being thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
The difference was the idea that they were inevitable in each person's life, that they were organizing principles that you could find in every single life. You know, there used to be a joke that was told about psychoanalysts. The old psychoanalyst says, yeah, he said, you know, I analyzed the guy's Oedipus complex. It's not my fault he didn't get better. That's what that conveys, the attitude that everybody is basically the same in their intrapsychic world, and it's a matter of making that clear. Erwin can talk about this. He has written about it actually quite a bit. But the idea was to individualize the understanding of people and make it specific to the transference, countertransference as well. That what comes up between two people in the analytic situation, especially the unconscious parts of it, that can be revealed and explicated, understood, felt directly, are particular to the relationships they've had in their lives, especially the ones early on. And that's what needs to be done, rather than to offer interpretations as packets of information that are passed across the room from the analyst to the patient. There's something more immediately experiential going on.
Yeah, and in that regard, from the beginning, there was a skepticism about universal theories. That is, as Don said, theories that are applied to everyone. And I don't think anyone more than Benjamin Wallstein has made this the centerpiece of his work, because number one, he was very skeptical about metapsychology, any kind of metapsychology. There was an interpersonal effort to sort of be atheoretical, which is of course impossible, but to veer toward minimizing theory, where the classical psychoanalysts was a very theory strong way of ethos. But Wallstein's credo was each patient is unique, each analyst is unique, each dyad is unique. And basically, I don't want to assume anything about you until I get to know you personally. And this analysis is not going to be exactly the same, and the interpretive schema is not going to be the same as the guy I saw the session before you. So the idea of, in a sense, being ignorant, Don has written a great deal about the curiosity, the virtue of curiosity, and curiosity comes from a certain degree of ignorance. I don't know you. I don't know if you have an Oedipal complex. I can't assume you do, or, have civil rivalry or any of that. And so I think that that was an important tone set in the interpersonal world.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of fundamental, ideas that are presented in the book. Each writer has, in a sense, has some of them. Like Harold Searles seems to, one of the ideas, beside, of course, using his countertransference, using his own self, but also the idea of the patient as an adult, the patient who can handle something rather than kind of being developmentally at a certain stage. Also, kind of, you could see a lot of the writers grappling with the sense of what is the unconscious. I think in the classical sense, the unconscious was kind of interpreted by the analyst, and that in the interpersonal paradigm, it's more kind of something that goes on between people and is enacted. So that seems to be an important idea that a lot of the writers, especially in the first volume, are struggling with. Ideas about self-disclosure, Darlene Ehrenberg certainly speaks to that. So it seems like there are writers kind of trying to formulate a certain theory. Not that there isn't a theory in interpersonal psychoanalysis, there seems to be, but trying to delineate their own theory as opposed to classical psychoanalysis.
Well, the theory revolves around the nature of the interpersonal field. And you have to remember how different psychoanalysis was in 1945. The idea of the interpersonal field was just not formulated, except by the beginnings of the writings of these people. Neither was the idea of the significance of the analyst subjectivity. The title of the book, of Irwin's selected papers, is The Interpersonal Tradition, and then the subtitle is The Origins of Psychoanalytic Subjectivity. That's not by accident. The notion that the subjectivity of the analyst and the subjectivity of the patient and how they relate to one another in the field was really new. At this point, there are still big differences, and I teach at conservative institutes not that infrequently. I see them all the time. They think that quite often, they think that they understand it. It turns out they really don't, and they're kind of shocked to find out how different it still is. However, the reason they're shocked is because they've been led to believe that psychoanalysis has been interpersonalized. And, there's a way in which that's true. There's a way in which these ideas are now not anathema the way they were. And that's shown in clinical and intellectual writings, but also in the politics of the field. Some years ago, after many years of trouble about this, in which the American Psychoanalytic Association required ridiculous changes in order for the White Institute to join it. Instead, the American Psychoanalytic Institute unanimously invited the White Institute to join with no changes. So that actually, there was some debate about it because it wasn't a slam dunk, but it eventually was accepted. And we now do talk with them, I think, in a different way than we used to. Nevertheless, these differences about the field persevere.
Yeah, it's evident. Don is teaching a course in New York Psychoanalytic, and he's on the editorial boards of a couple of the most classical journals. That's a fairly recent phenomenon. That's stuff like that happened. There were at the American Psychoanalytic meetings, there are a number of interpersonal and relational people who present, quite frequently.
I can remember back in the 80s when it was just beginning to happen, when I would see the Steve Mitchell or Ed Levinson had a paper in a journal that would never even have allowed our papers to be reviewed. We're publishing those papers. It was thrilling. It was thrilling. I had mixed feelings about being thrilled because there's a little bit of there's a little bit of the identification with the aggressor in there, right? But I was thrilled because it had been so distressing that my teachers had not been able to garner the admiration and respect that they deserved.
Yeah, how would you say that that you chose the articles for the book based on this? Like, did you choose them to illustrate particular concepts? And it must have been difficult. There, it actually is a large amount of interpersonal writing. So how were you able to pare it down? How did you do it between the two of you?
Well, there's you want to go, Erwin?
There's an overlap in the two books. I think six or seven of the articles are written by the same people, and you know that six or seven people appear in both volumes. And
Ocean Stern being two of them.
Yes. Your own articles are included.
There's absolutely no bias in choosing our own work to appear.
Not at all.
It's purely an objective decision. Otherwise, we just put our heads together and to try to find articles that seem to, you know, be among the most profound written by people identified as interpersonal. But of course, we also, there are some people who were known as important contributors to the literature, who published a good deal, and we wanted to get them in, you know, in the first volume, you know, people like Joseph Barnett and David Schechter in the second volume, people like John Fiscalini or Mark Fleschner.
We were looking for
articles of theirs that, you know, we thought was the best of their work.
And so it was a combination, really, Chris. We started off with a bunch of names of people who needed to be represented in volumes that had this purpose, and then we would pick some paper that satisfied a compromise between significance and the kind of length we could manage in the book, and we would choose that article. And then there were some papers that were written by people who haven't written a ton, but they just had great significance. For example, Kathy White's paper on racism. You know, that's a standout paper. And so there were a few papers that we picked that way.
Yeah, Roberta Hill Weiss, who died so young, but would have written a great deal, had a terrific paper. And, you know, she wasn't known and had published much because she died prematurely.
Yeah, I was familiar. I'm familiar with the interpersonal literature. I knew a lot of the articles, but just the other day I did go over and read the Roberta Held Weiss article. It's an incredible article. It is such a find.
Yeah. Well, you know, we actually she died at, I think, 54, had just started her writing career, we have a named lectureship in which a scholar every year comes to the White Institute, called the Roberta Held Weiss Scholar, serves as the scholar for the year and writes a paper which is delivered to the Society of White Graduates. Precisely because she was recognized as someone whose life was tragically cut short but had immense talent.
Yeah. It seems like one of the other great shifts, and Erwin, you mentioned it, was the relational shift when the Greenberg and Mitchell book came out. I believe it was 1983, and I guess part of the reasons you wrote this book was because it seems like the interpersonal tradition was being subsumed into the relational tradition, and you wanted to kind of make it more distinctive. And I know this is a kind of a lengthy, could be a lengthy discussion in itself, but maybe to delineate between the two might be helpful, or to kind of say where the interpersonal tradition stands now in relation to the relational position.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure if Don and I see this exactly the same, but we've both written about it. So let me say where what I think. I think the interpersonal tradition was the most important contributor to the broader relational tradition. Relational psychoanalysis is an umbrella term, or they call it the big tent. It includes a whole bunch of perspectives that have some important things in common. Most importantly, they are not dry theories. So primary among them are Kleinians and object relations, you know, middle school object relations, self-psychology, attachment theory. And there, first of all, Greenberg and Mitchell coined the term, were both trained interpersonally at the White Institute. Even in their doctoral degrees at NYU, they had enormously exposed to interpersonal influence.
I think, I don't know whether you'd agree, Erwin, that the introduction that you wrote is focused around this question, but actually, Chris, the introduction I wrote is focused around precisely this question.
Mm-hmm.
It takes the position that the differences between interpersonal psychoanalysis and contemporary Freudian psychoanalysis today are less important in establishing whether or not interpersonal psychoanalysis is a unique intellectual and clinical venture than the differences between interpersonal and relational psychoanalysis. I wrote a long introduction in which that was I've written about it before in other places too, but this was the most recent one and maybe the most complete. What I say, I'll just read you a couple lines, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I have argued that radical field theory leads to a number of outcomes: a de-emphasis on unconscious fantasy and repressed memories as templates for conscious experience, an emphasis on fantasy as mystified experience, a correspondingly greater emphasis on the embeddedness of the past in the forms of the present, as opposed to existing separately in the mind, and most of all, the continuous unconscious mutual influence of the subjectivities of analyst and patient on one another. It goes without saying, though, that the last of these points, while it did originate in interpersonal psychoanalysis, and there I cite Erwin, is shared today by all relational analysts. When this point is combined with the positions I've outlined about fantasy, memory, and the past and the present, and the existential humanistic sense of the emotional immediacy of the psychoanalytic situation, the result is what I hope, what I believe, is a coherent psychoanalytic perspective. And then it's our hope that this is the view that will inform your reading of the essays.
And I think both of us, both Don and I, would agree, Chris, that many people who identify as relational, who've been trained at NYU postdoctoral in the relational track, many of them are completely indistinguishable from interpersonal. That is, you know, in a blind taste test, one could not tell the difference. But there are other traditions within relational that are really quite different, particularly in terms of how therapy is conducted. And so those people identify as relational and come from a tradition, or are most influenced by a Winnicottian tradition or a Cohutian tradition, are really different in many, many ways than those people who call themselves relational and are influenced by the interpersonal group.
Yeah,
I would agree. I would agree. There are different groups within the relational group, and you know, I mean, I know, Chris, I know you're aware of this, but don't forget, or our listeners maybe, that when Steve Mitchell formulated relational psychoanalysis, while he did say that the interpersonal point of view, as far as he was concerned, was the most important tributary, that he also was including object relations in a broad sense. and self-psychology. So, so there's still room for differentiation, I think.
Well, it does seem that...
There are people, I mean, Don, for instance, or Phil Bromberg, or myself would say, you know, and Steve Mitchell said that, not on the record, but off the record, that, you know, he's both relational and interpersonal. It's sort of interpersonal slash relational, or relational slash interpersonal, but it could be relational slash Winnicottian, relational slash self-psychological.
I always identify myself as interpersonal, relational, and Philip does the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you do that, Erwin? I don't remember.
Yeah.
Usually you do too. Yeah.
So, it goes under that big umbrella. Then a lot of people just feel like it's kind of a it's almost necessary to identify yourselves with both. The relational movement, relational orientation, seem to really expand on the interpersonal work.
I don't think that's quite right. I think it certainly used the interpersonal work. But to say that it expanded on it is, I would say that they're different points of view.
Mm-hmm.
They're quite closely related, and I wouldn't want anybody in either group to think that I didn't feel that I belonged to both.
Right. I was thinking also the relational influence seems to be more international in scope. We recently had a podcast here, and it was our most popular podcast that we've had so far, that was focused, I guess, most on Lacanian and Kleinian theories, which seems to kind of almost be, in a way, either a resurgence or a kind of a pushback against the idea of drive theory and kind of notions of where the unconscious lays. That it seems to be quite popular, if not, I think, in the United States, but also elsewhere. As opposed to the interpersonal thinking, that that there seems to be still a lot of drive theorists out there.
Yeah, sure. John, you probably know more about that than me, but yes, I think Lacan and Dion are, you know, probably have more international influence than any other two theorists. And
Klein, the three of them.
And, mm-hmm, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Though the relational group is, you know, has a big international following too, you know, in Australia and Israel and Italy.
The International Association of Relational Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy, IARP, is about the same size as the American Psychoanalytic Association.
Oh, is it? No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
It's spread all over the world, whereas the JAPA, the APSA, is an American Psychoanalytic Association, is all here. But if you looked at psychoanalysis around the world, that's what I meant earlier when I said I think we've been terribly ethnocentric. The world has been going on without us in a way that has been quite fine with them. And as far as I'm concerned, we need to catch up. Well, so do they, because they really don't know us, but we have begun to know them, and we should. We all belong to the same field. We have so much more to do with one another's ideas than any of us have to do with the ideas of people in any other field. Nevertheless, there are big differences. I don't think they're going to go away anytime soon. I'm quite happy with pluralism.
What is the future of interpersonal psychoanalysis? Where do you think it's going? I think the second volume especially shows some of the direction that it's pointed in. So can you speak to that a little bit?
Erwin?
I don't know.
You got a thought?
I don't know, other than saying in a kind of an elaboration on what's already been there. I don't know that I could answer that question specifically. I'm still sort of stuck on your last question, mm-hmm. Don referred to as pluralism. Personally, kind of daunts me that that was the most successful podcast, and it would be more successful than some interpersonal podcast, because to me, interpersonal psychoanalysis is sort of the most, and some of relational psychoanalysis is the most anti-metapsychology and anti-strong theory. And I do think, you know, citing Eric Fromm and Escape from Freedom, that there is enormous appeal to much more structured theories and much more strong theories, which in a way make one have a clear script on how one works. And I think it's sort of a common human desire to have that sort of clarity. And I account for that, that interest in that way. And, you know, I don't like it. It's hard to say I don't like pluralism, because that doesn't sound so good, but I don't like that there's still an interest toward highly technical theoretical points of view, because it feels more structured and more like science.
Well, it does seem to me from some of the writing in the book that it does seem to be getting a little more theoretical. Maybe, I don't know if that's Irwin, if you would say that's a good thing or not, but that I always felt that the one of the ideas of interpersonal thinking was that advanced or kind of very abstract theories were really for the benefit of the analyst, not for the patient, and that was kind of part of the reason not to adhere to strong metapsychology. Although it does seem like it might be shifting a little bit.
I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you. You know, it might be, but I don't draw the same lines that Irwin would or Ed Levinson would around, you know, so-called, or that you would, Chris, mm-hmm. around strong metapsychology versus weak metapsychology. I mean, I don't really see how you can't. You need to be able to conceive the ideas, the structure, any coherent perspective in psychoanalysis, whether you want to call those ideas, or you want to call them values, or you want to call them theories, you know, they're different, but they all have that same agglutinizing, you know, cohering effect on the ideas that they contain or that they hold together. So I don't have the sense that that there's an essential difference between, well, for example, I'm a great admirer of Ed's writing. Ed, as a matter of fact, I might say that Ed's the
Ed Levinson.
Yes, Ed Levinson. I might say he's the single most influential living analyst on my thinking. But even though that's true, I don't agree with him when he characterizes his own work as not very theoretical by comparison to other people's. I think he's a wonderful writer and a hell of a lot better writer than 99% of the other people in our field. And that it can appear that he's writing about, you know, everyday experience without there being anything imposed upon it. But I think that's right.
Yeah, I would say it's a much less complicated theory. I agree there is inevitably some theory. But what's the theory? The theory is that we all become who we are because of our history of interpersonal relationships and the internalization of those relationships. And fundamentally, we are unconsciously motivated by those internalizations that have never been formulated, to use a term that now is central to psychoanalytic thinking, started by Don, originated with Don. That's a very loose theory, because each person internalizes very different people from their familial world, And that feels like a much broader, looser, non-specific theory than Beyond's theory, you know, for instance. Which,
I don't know. In Beyond's later theory, he gets downright mystical. He's very loose. It's really just his early theory that isn't. But leave that aside. If I accept your use of the word loose, that's okay with me. I can accept that. It's just a loose theory is no less a theory. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
I'm in the midst, to tell you the truth, I'm reading Lacan with some of my study groups, and I don't agree with it at all. Mm-hmm. But I must say that I find it exhilarating to grasp the relationships between, you know, this, what was going on in this guy's mind was really interesting. But I agree with you. It's not the way I want to work. I want to work according to interpersonal principles.
So it's clear that within the interpersonal school, the interpersonal tradition, there can be a lot of disagreement. There are a lot of ways to be an interpersonalist.
Well, there always was, because Sullivan and Fromm were so different.
They were so different, that's true.
Described earlier, Sullivan and Fromm were profoundly different. And I agree with Dahl's earlier comment that Fromm's clinical influence is much greater than Sullivan's. But Sullivan did have, at least in the early days, some significant clinical influence, and it had issued detailed inquiry and the avoidance of addressing transference themes. And there are still some Sullivanians around. So.
So we're coming to the end of our time. So I just wanted to give you a chance to add anything you feel that we didn't get to or left out. Anything that you'd like to say?
Well, one thing that has always been very important to me in terms of why interpersonal psychoanalysis has always appealed to me, in addition, and what's unique, I believe, what's unique about it, in addition to what Don described a few minutes back, is the question of hierarchy. We are all more simply human than otherwise. Speaks to participant observation, that the analytic relationship is one between two subjective co-participants, between two flawed co-participants. And so the turn in psychoanalysis started with Sullivan's participant observation is that the analyst is a subjective other, and by definition, obviously not an objective other, and obviously by definition, not a healthier, saner other. And that collapse of hierarchy, because of issues in my own personal life growing up, has always been very important to me, and always a big part of my what I write about in my embrace of the interpersonal tradition.
Well, this is something that Erwin has, you know, conveyed to me for many years, and I couldn't agree with it anymore. I do. If you ask me what I have left to say, might be something about the future that you mentioned before, which is that I think that the idea of the field, whether it's not always the interpersonal field, and for example, in Italy they call it the bipersonal field or the joint unconscious fantasy, which is a very different thing. But there is a greater understanding and acceptance in the world at large of the idea of the field being inevitable, that these are two individual real people dealing with one another in ways that have to do with their own unconsciouses, going back to really to Ferenczi. Ferenczi then grew up through the interpersonalists. He came through the interpersonalists to us. But what I think is that the interpersonal view is still by far the most thoroughly bidirectional, reciprocal understanding of the field that exists. If we had time, I'd say something about, you know, the work of Farrow and Civitarese, which I admire and am very interested in. But something about, I've written about this, about how how it's not really reciprocal, because the projective identifications are only supposed to go in one direction. That's not true in interpersonal psychoanalysis, in which the clinical situation is a two-way street. It's a level playing field. The analyst is involved with the patient in the same way that the patient's involved with the analyst. The difference is the roles they occupy, not anything else.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah,
John
wrote two terrific papers in psychoanalytic dialogues comparing the different field theorists.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. I mean, we could certainly go on much longer. There's so much more to cover, but we do have to end here. I just wanted to say they're two great books for anyone in any orientation to read, and they're just I think essential for almost anyone doing clinical work. So I just have to thank you for doing this, for putting the books together.
Well,
thank you
for doing this and for interviewing us and doing public relations for us. That's much appreciated.
Sure. Sure. Thank you. We've been speaking to Dr. Owen Hirsch and Dr. Donald Stern, the writers of the series of books, The Interpersonal Perspective in Psychoanalysis, from the 1960s to the 1990s, and then from the 1980s to the 2010s. Thanks so much. This has been Chris Bandini, and thank you for listening.